You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You just found the very best in original talk radio broadcasting on the internet. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want. What we want. You're listening to On the Couch. On the Couch with Dr. Michelle on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch. Welcome, everyone. As always, a terrific show today. Fascinating and intriguing, stimulating. You'll just want to hang on to this one and possibly call in if you'd like. Hey, why are so many of the TV shows that reenact real crimes so fascinating? Why do we love this stuff, huh? Well, you know, they describe through detective work how evil criminals or murderers are finally caught. You know, they have these reenactments going on. And I think the fascination we hold is because most of us, we really can't understand the mind of someone who would torture or murder innocent people. We really want to see the bad guy, as has always been, you know, in film, books, theater, radio programs, the old times. We want to see him caught. We want to see the bad guy get their justice. Why would someone kill just for the sake of it? Might they be insane, have some voices or delusions which are driving them to kill? And are they guilty if they do? Not of insanity. You know, we learn about notorious characters in the news, like Ariel Castro. Now, he's convicted of imprisoning and abusing three women for a decade. Now, terrorists, the murderer, the Boston bomber, Mr. Sarnia, Whitey, you know, our mobster friend, finally got enough evidence against him to get arrested. Jeez, guys living here in Santa Monica in Southern California, living La Vida Loca, and they finally catch up to him. You know, these people have no conscience about torturing or murdering innocent victims. What is it in these people's brains that makes them have absolutely no conscience or a sense that they must kill? Well, today we are going to get some answers to these and many more questions from my special guest. He's Dr. Mark Rubenstein. Now, you may remember my last interview. I think I interviewed him, gosh, it's been not even 8 months ago. And he talked about his fascinating novel at the time, Mad Doghouse. That was great stuff. But today we're talking about his latest suspenseful book. It's entitled Love Gone Mad. And it's not only skillfully written, it's a fascinating thriller and very psychological. So we're going to talk more about it and why people do the things they do. Dr. Mark Rubenstein is a physician, psychiatrist, assistant professor of psychiatry, to name a few things. Of course, he's written journals, many professional papers. He's been published. But he also writes mystery thrillers, which is really cool. And most of the stories are about people involved in life and death struggles with forces that they cannot control. And that's the crux of our nightmares, isn't it? Welcome to the show, Dr. Rubenstein. So nice
it's
to have
Mark,
you.
Mark, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know what? It's great to have you, Mark. Listen,
great to be here.
Good book. What a read.
Living the Vida Loca.
You like that?
Yeah.
You know, it's true. I mean, we don't get it. We don't understand why these people do the things they do. Or, well, you do. You've been a forensic psychologist for a long time, working with people who have committed crimes. And it's fascinating to me. It must be fascinating to you.
It is. The characters in Love Gone Mad, however, or at least the one of the characters around whom the book, at least to a great extent, orbits, is not he's not a pathological character or killer in the sense of what James Holmes or the Boston Marathon bomber.
Right.
He is obsessed by love. It's really a love story from a few different angles. Two people meet and fall in love, and there's somebody lurking in the background who has an obsession. And I think we all know and understand that hell hath no fury like a lover crossed or spurned. When there's an unrequited obsession, we see it and we love it in films like Fatal Attraction, or Misery, or Taxi Driver, The Jagged Edge, Swim Fan, Sleeping with the Enemy. I mean, there are film people eat this stuff up because it twists our stomachs to see some of what happens. But there's nothing as spine-tingling as facing the things we dread most in life. And those are, I think, among others, rejection, being stalked, fearing for our lives, and we enjoy the suspense and even the terror as long as it's not happening to you and me.
Exactly, exactly. And that's the thing. We can be the observer. When we're reading your book, Love Gone Mad, or when we're watching those ID shows or some of those other 48-hour shows, you know, we're catching the criminal.
Sure.
What is this about? The scorned woman, you know, who the bleep did I marry? Those kind of programs. And it's fascinating to be the observer, but when we're into it, that it must be horrifying. It must be absolutely horrifying.
People are still talking, Michelle, about the boiled bunny from Fatal Attraction.
God,
I mean, you know.
I drew bunnies, man. That's right.
Of course, we all remember how Glenn Close in that film stalked Michael Douglas.
That's right.
Not that he was the greatest guy on earth. He was two-timing his wife, but that was a classic story of unrequited obsessional love.
That's right.
And to some extent, Love Gone Mad really deals with some of that, but also deals with the nature of love in a non-pathological setting, and you know, what is love, and when does a person cross the line between being deeply in love and going insane?
That's right. These people need a little spiritual training. You know what I'm saying? Need to talk to their religious leaders, rabbis or whatever, but I don't think they have their wherewithal to do that. And this is what I'm talking about. You know, you mentioned Glenn Close. Well, she was, or the other actress in Play Misty for Me. They were full on borderlines. Full on.
Absolutely.
So that's
how about Kathy Bates in Misery when she was basically taking a sledgehammer to James Conn's leg? And that, of course, is taken from the novel by Stephen King.
Sure.
That wasn't really stalking so much as it was entrapment and keeping a prisoner, a la Mr. Castro, who you mentioned just a few minutes ago.
Oh, my God. And that's the thing, and I want to get into that a little bit, because I think a lot of people are fascinated between, to understand the difference between, someone who is really mentally incapable of controlling themselves, and we'll talk about that a little bit, and just pure evil. And how do we determine whether they are, and this is what's great about your book, Love Gone Mad, too, is you have an interesting twist in there. But
well, there's
like
a trial in the
that.
Book. There's a trial in which, I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but there's a trial in which the defendant is claiming NGRI, which in the law means not guilty by reason of insanity. And in a novelistic way, I think, among other things, the reader comes away with a really good understanding of what that's all about and what's involved in that kind of a defense. And in a sense, this is also a legal thriller, in addition to being an out-and-out pulse pounder of a thriller in which people are stalked and chased and awful things happen or nearly happen.
Well, it helps us take a look also at our legal and psychiatric system and sort of makes us doubt a little bit the power of, oh, the system works, really? How did it slip between these people's, hands? How did this guy get, well, I'm not going to get into it because I want folks to check out your book. How did the idea of Love Gone Mad come to you to write this book?
Well, it's a funny thing, you know, how ideas come to writers is always, at least to me, a fascinating topic. Mm-hmm. I have to tell you a very brief vignette, and this is the way the chain of thought started for mm-hmm. me. I have an office in Connecticut where I practice psychiatry, and the receptionist downstairs is the receptionist essentially for a real estate agency downstairs. Mm. And one day she brought her very cute, very pretty little 7-year-old daughter into the office. The child had a day off from school. So mm-hmm. I came downstairs, leaving at a certain hour of the day, and this great-looking, very personable kid who I'd met a couple of times before is there, and I said, "Well, hello," I say to her, and she says, "You know what? You remind me of my dad."
Okay.
So I said to her, "Well, you know, I wish you were my kid."
Right.
So she says to me, "Well, you'd have to marry my mom first." And the second, the receptionist is blushing and turning purple.
Right.
So it made me think, what would happen if a man who is married and has a child begins to believe that the child isn't really his?
Right.
That it's someone else's, another man's child. Mm-hmm. And that began a train of thought, and mm-hmm. I started to write. And then, of course, you know, in the process of writing, you reorganize, you rewrite, you edit, and then you take chapter 14 and move it to chapter 2, and you start to see things you hadn't before.
Yes.
And the next thing you know, you have a twisting tale of twisted obsession and I hope a pulse-pounding, stirring thriller that really began with the most innocent little comment by a child about her paternity.
Isn't that interesting? That's a cool story. But that's the way, I'm going to say this, you artists, that's the way you think. I mean, you take and you weave a story based on information and you know, you go off in little branches and what ifs. And I don't know, that's what the creative mind does.
It's a what if.
Yeah.
You hit it right on the head, Michelle. It's a what if scenario.
Uh-huh.
I ask myself that question all the time. Like in Mad Dog House, I said, what if you're a doctor and your best friend's an accountant, and somebody you haven't seen in 30 years comes to you and says, "I'd like you to join me as a silent partner in a Manhattan steakhouse."
Uh-huh. Right.
What if? Well, that's all you need to start a story.
That's right, exactly. No offense or anything, but a lot of scholarly psychiatrists, physicians such as yourself, you know, they're not as creative. I mean, you have to deal with drama every day. You're analyzing, you're doing psychiatric evaluations, you're training people. But a lot of, you know, psychiatrists are not as, fascinating, what if, and create a story, because I see that they, as a psychologist, a lot of times, we have to clear our minds. We have to let a lot of the drama go. We have to live our lives outside of that office. So I don't know how you do it. I don't know how
It's funny. You talk about stories and drama.
Yeah.
Drama always fascinated me. I originally had a degree in business administration, and then I went into the Army, and I was just assigned randomly to the medical corps, and I came out, and I decided, you know, medicine is great, because I was involved in a lot of field surgery with paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne.
Mm.
And the next thing I know, I was back in college, and I ended up applying to medical school and was accepted. And I'd always loved reading novels and stories. And then above all medical specialties, I found that psychiatry appealed to me because every patient had a different story to tell. Mm. Whereas in medicine, you know, you can see 50 people in a row and they have high blood pressure, they have heart failure, they have whatever. But the cases, all 99% of cases are really 5 or 6 basic disorders. But in psychiatry, every patient has a different story. And then when I began presenting psychiatric cases at conferences, people would say, you know, your cases sound like novels when you present them. So I was always fascinated by stories, and mm-hmm. and that's what I've done. And finally, I turned to just writing fiction, which kind of taps into the love I always had of stories and what attracted me to psychiatry, or would have attracted me, let's say, to psychology if I hadn't first gone to medical school. So storytelling and listening to stories has always been something that I've loved.
That's a good combination. Good for you. By the way, in case you just tuned in here on LA Talk Radio, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle and my special guest today, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's a physician, psychiatrist, assistant professor of psychiatry, and, of course, you may have heard him in reruns here. I love to have him featured on the show because he writes mystery thrillers about, you know, people involved in life and death struggles and forces they cannot control. Today we're talking about his latest novel, Love Gone Mad. It's about sociopathic murders, basically. Or the passion of love. Where do we draw the line there? Why do you think people are so fascinated with these themes and criminal characters, Mark?
I think everyone loves suspense. You know, from the earliest times of our lives, we always want to be told stories. I mean, there's nothing as so primal, in a sense, as sitting on mom or dad's lap and having them read to you. And I almost every kid, at least when I was a kid, that was something that was really a very significant experience. Most of us love the movies and stories, novels, even if it's just gossiping between and amongst ourselves. We love, and what happened next is what we all want. We love a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah.
You know, namely, it has a plot, something that drives one's interest towards some finite conclusion. Even most literary novels do that. The most satisfying reads are those that really have a narrative drive, a plot that compels. It doesn't have to be a page-turner necessarily, but something that propels your interest beyond the beauty of the writing or the descriptions or the snappiness of the dialogue.
Yes.
So what really propels these things is suspense, wanting to know what comes next, and let's face it, we all tend to rubberneck when we pass an accident on the side of the road. People are fascinated by either violence or blood, or as long as it doesn't happen to them or their loved ones. You know, we are all fascinated by these things. This is why programs like CSI and Law and Order and, you know, all these thriller 24 and Homeland, all of it is sub Breaking Bad, which is coming on next week. The final six sessions.
God, that's right. Boy, that draws us in, doesn't it?
We are fascinated by these things because they're beyond the realm of ordinary human experience, for most of us at least, and we want to know what's going to happen next. I mean, is Walter White going to die at the end?
I don't know. You know,
did Tony Soprano die at the end of The Sopranos?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Exactly.
So this is, I think, what fascinates people. It's vicariously living the vida loca.
There you go. You've got that right. Now, I know you have worked in forensics a long time. I've worked with several people who have been committed of crimes. It's not my favorite kind of work.
Nor mine.
Okay. All right. I hear that.
As long as we're being honest.
Let's just lay it out there. Yeah. I mean, I recall working with people, I mean, years ago, who, let's say, had voices. One particular client comes to mind, bipolar one woman, had, you know, voices in her manic psychosis telling her that, you know, she randomly went into a public place and saw a 9-year-old young man, little boy, with his mom. Voices said, "He is the devil's son. You need to kill him immediately." So she took this poor little soul out of the store, drug him to her car, unbeknownst to mom. Mom thought he was just sitting there kind of with her, very cleverly, and started to assault this poor little soul in the parking lot. Now, thank God there were people watching, and he was screaming, and people are, "What is going on?" So this was an identifiable chemical imbalance. You know, she had hallucinations. She was audio hallucinations. So I get it, and that is criminally insane. Probably like James Holmes, who you mentioned, you know, earlier.
Probably is, although, you know, you hate to make diagnoses
yeah.
from afar, but certainly
right.
Initial evidence would point to his being an absolutely insane person.
Exactly.
Just for the sake of clarity, I'd like to sort of, I don't want to give the whole history of it, but forensic psychiatry was really born out of the English common law in basically the 19th century,
yeah.
in the early to mid 1850s. Originally, it went by what was called the McNaughton rule, and
right.
A person was adjudged to be criminally insane and could be found not guilty by reason of insanity,
right.
if he had what basically amounted to either an irresistible impulse
mm-hmm.
or was incapable of understanding the nature of his or her act
mm-hmm.
by virtue of some mental
mm-hmm.
disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basis upon which the NGRI, that is the not guilty by
right.
reason
yes.
of insanity
yes.
plea, rests.
Right.
I'd also like to clear up a couple of myths about it.
Okay.
Number one, it's an extremely rare claim by a defendant.
Okay.
Very few, less than 0.25% of criminal defendants plead NGRI. So that's, you know, one myth is that this is an abused kind
yeah.
of out for people who are defendants in criminal matters.
Yes. Yeah.
0.25%, actually less, claim that. And of that very small percentage, very, very few, less than 0.25% of that
mm-hmm.
Population mm-hmm. are actually found NGRI.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me just mention one more myth. I'm
yeah.
sure you know it, Michelle, but perhaps your audience mm-hmm. is not familiar with it. People think that if someone is declared not guilty by reason of insanity,
mm-hmm.
that the person, quote-unquote, has gotten off, unquote. And that is by no means the case.
Correct.
Every single state in the United States abides by the Jones v., I believe it was Colorado. I'm not 100%
right.
sure on which state it was, but
right.
this goes back to the 1950s
mm-hmm.
when it was adjudicated by the Supreme Court that a defendant found NGRI
mm-hmm.
can be locked away involuntarily in
yes.
a state mental institution
right.
for the criminally insane,
right.
and that the acquittee, as he's called,
yes.
the acquittee can be held involuntarily in that prison hospital
yes.
for a period of time longer than he or she would have served had that person been convicted of the crime,
that's right.
had he or she been found guilty of committing the crime.
Right.
So
right,
it is
right.
a long-standing myth that people get away with this stuff.
Exactly.
They don't. They don't get away with anything.
That's important to point out, you know, for listeners who really don't understand, you know, our criminal justice system and where they do end up. I think the media depicts people who plead and are, you know, decided to be not guilty through reason of insanity, as, you know, sitting in the funny farm, weaving baskets, having a lovely time in a wheelchair in the sun and taking their meds. And, you know, I think the media is guilty of that sometimes. I mean, this is not a fun place to be.
That is so
you know?
Far, yeah,
yeah.
That depiction is so far
yeah.
from the truth that, it, you
yeah.
know, it's laughable. I mean, these people are medicated. They are held
oh, yeah.
once a year, what's called a PSRB, the Psychiatric Services Review Board,
yeah.
meets. It's sort of like a parole hearing, you know, the
yeah.
typical parole hearing for a really seriously
right.
sociopathic
right.
Killer. You know, you can have a parole hearing once
yeah.
a year, but it's a rubber stamp no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yes.
you know, the guy may get out in 30 years, but
yeah.
It's the same thing with PSRBs. I mean, the Psychiatric Services Review Board will, it's a group of people who have had intimate contact with the acquittee over the period of a year, and they all confer
mm-hmm.
and decide whether or not that person is even eligible
mm-hmm.
To go out off the grounds for a half hour,
mm-hmm.
Such as happened, by the way, with Sean Hinckley,
yes.
the fellow who tried to kill Ronald Reagan because he was trying to impress Jodie Foster. He's still crazy.
Right.
He's still psychotic.
Yes.
And, you know, he was found, I believe he was found in a in a store looking up pictures of Jodie Foster. So, you know, he's still as disturbed as he ever was, and he's never going to get out.
That's exactly right. I have I recall another client years ago who went into the facility, the mental institution for criminally insane. She had... She didn't kill someone, but it was attempted murder because of the insanity of voices, once again. And so the other voice, well, she was there. She was in there a long time. Her other voice told her, well, she was there, and she was medicated, so it doesn't always work. All the medications don't always do the trick, but backed off some of those other voices. But the good voice was telling her, if I act like a very sweet actress, if I act like a very sweet, prim and proper, if I become Doris Day, then they're going to think I'm wonderful and they're going to let me out of here. So if I'm gracious and always well-groomed and pretty and funny and light. So she assumed this character. And they were amazed. She was amazing in those interviews. She was, you know, up against the PSRP interviews. She was amazing. She was great. What a great actress. But,
well, there are some people who can fool the system. They can play the system and get by. It's very rare, but it can occur.
Yeah.
I'm not going to get into the plot line of Love Gone Mad because awful things occur, along with good things. But the plot line does involve somebody bringing the criminal justice, the legal system, and psychiatry and psychology to its knees, to their collective knees, in terms of what happens, and
which is good. It was a great ending. It was like, finally, I got some closure here, Mark.
it brings up a lot of issues about our criminal justice system, about psychiatry, psychology, about the NGRI plea, and about justice, and also most importantly about love and crossing that line and. What's going on.
No, exactly. It's a great read, by the way. In case you just tuned in here, my special guest, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, a physician, psychiatrist, assistant professor in psychiatry, and of course, he's a very creative writer. He usually writes mystery thrillers based on a lot of his own creative mind and his real-life experiences about people involved in life and death struggles and forces we cannot control. We're talking about his latest book today. It's entitled Love Gone Mad. Great, riveting story. About all that stuff you watch on the ID channel with a real twist that'll knock your socks off. We're going to be talking about how you can get a hold of his book later in the show. By the way, if you have a question for Dr. Rubenstein, I'm going to let the phones open now. I really wanted to get a real good feel for what's going on with his book and share with you some of his cool information. But if you'd like to call 323-203-0815. I can take your calls. Also, if you are shy, would rather not have your voice on the air, we can take emails directly here and answer them. Doc, D-O-C, Michelle with two L's at AOL.com, leading right here into the studio. So I wanted to ask you, this is a big question that I have, and hopefully it'll be interesting to the listeners. You spoke earlier about Glenn Close's, you know, character, of course, and also the play Misty for Me character and all that. Yeah, all those characters. Kathy Bates, you know, oh my God, all those scary sociopaths, or as they call them, people with antisocial personality disorder, who has the narcissistic edge and the lack of conscience. What is the difference between those guys and someone who has psychosis and voices?
Okay, well, as long as we're talking about psychosis, psychosis is basically defined, as you know, Michelle, as a person having an inability to separate reality from fantasy. That is, a person can no longer tell what's real from what's not real. Mm-hmm. And typically, the most prominent indications of psychosis are usually delusions and hallucinations. Now, you described, of course, auditory hallucinations, wherein a person hears a voice, and if it's a command hallucination, the voice tells you what to do.
Right.
And I was involved in a case years ago in which a man stabbed his own 7-year-old daughter to death because the devil told him to do that.
Yes.
He's still rotting away in a mental institution in Connecticut. The other hallmark of psychosis tends to be delusions. Mm-hmm. A delusion is a fixed false belief, one that the person adheres to despite evidence to the contrary. Mm-hmm. It's a belief that's not shared by one sociocultural group, and it's a belief that can often end up in the person with the person doing things that are contrary to the laws of society.
Yes.
A typical delusion is the FBI, the CIA, the KGB, and the Mossad are all following me, they're poisoning my water, and you know, it's an insane belief.
Yes, I've got bugs in my car and my computer, and they're following me, and there's cameras.
Absolutely.
I've had clients ask me, "Are there cameras watching me in your office?"
They are deluded. Yeah. These are paranoid delusions, or delusions of being followed, of being persecuted. There are delusions of jealousy, delusions of love, where somebody believes that some prominent star, Keira Knightley, is in love with me, and then they may begin to stalk Keira Knightley because they believe that she really has a profound interest in them. I mean, we've all heard of, you know, David Letterman getting stalked by this rather psychotic woman in Connecticut, New York. But the bottom line is that people who are psychotic are those who can't really distinguish reality from fantasy. On the other hand, a sociopathic, narcissistic personality can distinguish generally between reality and fantasy, but is so wrapped up in himself or herself that they don't see beyond their own needs, their own wishes, their own fantasies. They tend to have shallow relationships, and they tend to at times delude themselves into thinking that they are the center of the world. I don't mean literally, but that everything revolves around them. And and if they're really sociopathic, they also lack that inner voice of conscience that typically rules us all, and they can commit various acts and have absolutely no remorse and no feeling about it.
Right.
And many of the criminals who are in the criminal justice system, either behind bars or elsewhere, are indeed sociopaths and are not psychotic, but rather are people who don't have that inner barometer that prevents them from committing horrifying acts.
Wow. So are those folks who are defined as the sociopaths or having antisocial personality disorder, they basically, if that is proven, they can't plea not guilty by reason of insanity, correct? Because it doesn't meet
anybody
the criteria.
Anybody can lodge any plea he or she wants, but they're never going to prevail in that kind of a plea. Yeah, the only people who stand a chance of successfully pleading that are people who have a defined mental disorder and whose disorder is so severe and so altering of their perceptions of reality, be it by hallucinations or delusions, that they cannot confine their behavior to the or conform their behavior to the dictates of the law. The primary a hallmark that could define a successful plea of NGRI. But again, that person, even if found NGRI, is going to spend a very long time in prison, although it's not going to be a place like San Quentin or Attica or Sing Sing. It's going to be a psychiatric prison hospital.
Right, right. And just a side note, too, they really, you know, we can define medications. You know this as a psychiatrist, of course. We can define someone has a bipolar 1, let's say, with psychosis or schizophrenia, with, you know, and give them antipsychotics. And hopefully that will back off some of the symptoms. Hopefully we can give them these medications. But do medications really work for sociopaths or these antisocial personalities?
They don't, Michelle. They do not really do anything. There's nothing to medicate. You really can't medicate a personality disorder away. You can medicate severe symptoms away of psychosis, such as hallucinations or delusions, mm-hmm. or other symptoms such as panic attacks or generalized anxiety or a significant depression,
right.
A phobia. These can be medicated quite successfully with some of the latest generation medications.
Cool.
But when it comes to a distorted personality, we can't medicate that away. So
yeah.
there's really, and they are, as I know you know, these are virtually impossible to alter by virtue of psychotherapy or counseling or talk therapy. Some of that is very compellingly presented in The Sopranos.
Yes.
In his sessions with Dr. Melfi.
Exactly. And how does that make you feel?
Well, you know, I loved
that.
I
was
loved
her favorite line, right? Is that her favorite line, right?
I loved Tony. He was one of my favorite television characters of all time, a very complex man. Had elements of sociopathy in him also, but he loved vulnerable things like ducks and dogs, cats,
right.
And horses. He also had a soft spot for anyone whom he really saw as vulnerable in life. And had some good elements to him, but also could be ruthless and absolutely do what had to be done. And, of course, he had a terrible kind of upbringing with his mother and father. But the bottom line is that you know, Tony Soprano could never be helped by his panic attacks were helped by the medication, but his basic personality style was what it was.
I mean,
and that formed pretty much, it's really solidified by the time you're about 16 or 17, maybe 18 with some slight, very minor modifications. But you are what you are by the time you're about 18.
And I think a lot of people don't get that. I really do. And by the way, James Gandolfini will be, you know, missed so much. What a great actor. Thank you for mentioning that.
You know, I've been watching the reruns of The Sopranos lately, and the last episode was last night, literally last night. And the second time around, I could really much more appreciate some of the subtlety of his acting because I was, I mean, I knew what was happening, so I was a little less focused on the plot line and on the action and whatever, and I was just watching what a superb master he was.
Oh, God, he was. He got all those subtleties of those personality types, man. He was great.
Oh, yeah.
He did his homework.
He was a study in a very complex kingpin.
Yeah, exactly. In case you just tuned in here on LA Talk Radio, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle. My special guest today, who is a always welcomed guest, is Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's a physician, psychiatrist, assistant professor of psychiatry, on and on, many published papers. But also, he's such a creative writer. He writes great novels and murder mystery, thrillers kind of things. Today, we're talking about his latest book. It's called Love Gone Mad. And it is just that. It's a thriller and a novel. And we're going to tell you how you can get the book at the end of the show if you'd like. Because if you like to read, and it's well written. I love the color of your writing. I just love the color. I love the words.
Thank you.
Good stuff.
Thanks so much.
Good. It makes me smile when how you weave words together in a sentence. I go, yeah, that's great. We did such a good job here. But we were just talking about, for a moment, people's, you know, early upbringings, and you said that our personalities and much of our chemical imbalances, by the way, as well, they start to kind of show up. That's why we diagnose at about 18. But in your books, you include backstories about your characters, and you know, many times you write about the bad guys, as this character, by the way, in Love Gone Mad, having escaped a difficult childhood. So I think a lot of people don't understand how abusive and damaging, you know, parents or families or caregivers can affect someone's mind so severely as an adult.
Well, I tried to portray not only Conrad Wilson, who is someone who's somewhat unsavory in certain very profound respects, and his background and the deprivations and the horror of some of what he endured. But I also described Megan Haggerty, the neonatal nurse, who falls in love with with Adrian Douglas, the heart surgeon. Their backgrounds also had some very difficult things. I mean,
yes.
Adrian was adopted at a few days of age and never knew her biological parents, so there's the whole issue of adoption and what that means to a person.
Yes.
When he was just, I believe, 6 years old, Adrian saw his father die right in front of him of a heart attack while sitting in a Chinese restaurant with his mother and him.
God.
And that scarred him for life, and so among other things, he became a heart surgeon, you know, trying to cure or fix God's mistakes,
That's right.
Conrad, I don't even want to get into his background because it's part of what drives the story, but we are products of not only our constitutional genes and our biochemical mix, and we are somewhat fluid for a certain number of years, and during that period of fluidity, mixed in with our genetic combination of whatever it is, our genetic heritage, comes upbringing. It's the old nature and nurture routine.
Yeah,
we are what we are nurtured to be. We are what we what nature has also decreed we will be, and it's a combination thereof.
Of course.
And I tried to give, in an entertaining kind of thrilling way, some insight for the reader as to what makes people tick. Who are these people?
Yes. Exactly. Who are these people? And you do weave some fascinating backstories about these, each and every one of these.
Why
also,
is Megan a neonatal nurse? I mean, of all things to pick, to try and work with newborns who are in trouble and who need incubators and respirators. I mean, what makes a person pick something like that? That's really a tough field.
That
you know?
Really is. It's a very tough field, but when we get down deep and we understand where they're coming from and their need to, create or achieve something in this lifetime that they feel is undone, I mean, that's a lot, what a lot of it is about, as well as imprints. And I talk about this a lot, too, on my show, is the imprinting we receive in terms of the messages we get or the abuse we get, not worthy, not lovable, hated, people leave us in our lives, all those negative, and they imprint so deeply when we're adults or middle age, where they're still there. They're still there.
I mean, absolutely. I must say, I'm sure that this is the same for you, Michelle. As a psychiatrist, people come to me for help. So I have a very skewed view of the way many people function, because everybody who comes to me is troubled.
Yeah.
And in essence, everyone who comes to me is scarred. Mm. They are scarred more or less deeply. And that has impacted me in terms of my writing, in terms of some of what I view about people and human nature. You can develop a jaundiced view of people if you do too much of this work,
No, it's true, because it's all we're exposed to. And I mean, just like detectives or police who, all they see is crime every day. All they see is the bad guy, and they have a kind of a negative spin on the world, But if that's all you're exposed to, sometimes you sort of start, but there is a way that we need to filter out those things and clean up our own minds and try to take care of ourselves if we can.
In that vein, Michelle, I must tell you, I only have one friend who's a psychiatrist or a psychologist. All my friends are non-mental health professionals, because
that's
I don't want to talk shop. I don't want to hear about it. It's what I've dealt with for years, every day.
But with you, that's right. But with your psychiatric friends, you do get to kvetch. They get you. Right.
Well,
they get you.
I hear complaints all the time.
That's right. So these imprints are there, and they're very strong. Can therapy, as well as medication, reverse a lot of the effects of a horrifying childhood?
The jury's still out, to use a legal metaphor, the jury's still out on that. I don't think there's any definitive one-size-fits-all generic answer. When you talk about making changes and effecting some kind of therapeutic realignment, I view change, that is improvement equals change, Because people come to me because they want to change certain things in their lives, their patterns, their way of relating to others, the way they perceive the world around them, and so forth. Mm-hmm. When it comes to change, I sort of view change as, or the potential for change, as existing on a 90-degree angle. Mm-hmm. And if through psychotherapy, even without medication, I can get somebody to change that 90-degree angle by 2 or 3 degrees.
Yeah.
I feel I've accomplished a great deal, because at least the person has developed a degree of insight and can nip certain toxic patterns in the bud, and can really make some effective changes in their social lives, in their relationships with loved ones, with other people. Mm-hmm. It's difficult, it's hard work, but it can be done.
Yes.
But you're not going to find a total revamping. You're not going to find a 180-degree change in somebody. That's a fairy tale, and we sometimes see that in the movies, but that's not the way it works.
Well, that's true. Those neural patterns are pretty strongly formed.
And they're embedded.
They are embedded, and those thoughts are automatic.
So. But you and I, we try to be alchemists, you know. We try to turn horror into gold.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's positive. That's a very half full kind of positive thing, though. And I think it's true. Let's try to make this work. Let's pull you out of this. Let's start functioning in life and get something out of this conscious
Absolutely.
Experience.
Let's make life a lot better. Yeah.
Exactly. By the way, in case you just tuned in here, I'm talking to my special guest here, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. We're just about out of time here. He's a psychiatrist, of course, assistant professor of psychiatry, physician, been in the business for many years, and he writes mystery thrillers, primarily about people involved in life and death struggles and the forces they cannot control. You know, the mind stuff of our nightmares, basically. And the show's
Waking Nightmares.
There
yes.
you go. And the fascination that we have also with these other programs is all in his latest book. It's called Love Gone Mad. Now, your book's not coming out until September 1st, so how can folks pre-order your book?
Okay. The pre-order is so simple. You'd go to Amazon, and I got to tell you, it's deeply discounted. It is now $8.75 for a large trade paperback version.
Great.
And it will be retailing through Amazon. At least the retail price come September 1st will be $12.99. So it's really deeply discounted now at $8.75. On September 1st, it'll also be available as an e-book for Kindle only, although if you have a Kindle app, you can download it onto any reading device.
Mm-hmm.
And the Kindle app, of course, is free on any reader or tablet. And the cost there will be $3.99. So,
and
that begins on September 1st, but it can be pre-ordered now at a deep discount of, as I said, $8.75.
Mm-hmm.
It'll also be available September 1st in Barnes & Noble and in probably in your favorite bookstore, wherever that is. My big complaint is that there are fewer and fewer bookstores around.
Yeah, that's true. Exactly. I am holding the copy in my hands as we speak, and I'm proud to have it because I want to go back and reread some of the pieces to really get into the minds of some of these people. I'm like, what? Oh, God, that's so
good.
Don't
get frightened by the cover, Michelle.
It's a pretty scary cover. So, listen, thanks a million for being on the show, Dr. Rubenstein. So nice to have you here.
Thank you for having Michelle. You are great.
Oh, thank you. Likewise. And listen, come on back with your next novel. We'll talk more. I know you're working on something else. I know you are.
Oh, yeah. The sequel to Mad Dog House, which is
cool.
Mad Dog Justice. Roddy and Danny return because there was unfinished business at the end of the first one.
There sure was. And you did that on purpose. So we'll find out more about that. And have a lovely day, and thanks a million again for being on the show. I sure appreciate it.
You too, Michelle. Thanks so much.
All right. Have a good one now. Bye-bye. All right. Special guest there, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, and a great author. Always fun to listen to him and hear what he has to say. And this is Dr. Michelle Cohen. Woo, we're almost out of time here. You can stay on the couch, listen to more great programs here on LA Talk Radio. Coming up, we have a hard break for CBS News, let you know what's going on in the world. Next week, speaking about being out of control of your life with forces we cannot control, we're going to be talking to a woman who wrote a fascinating book about being the victim of abuse. It's not your same old story, though, that you're used to. It's about self-empowerment and looking for the signs and why we buy into people who come off wonderful and charming and lovely, who really are truly evil. Fascinating stuff. Great read. And I'll talk to you next week. Don't forget to take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for everyone else. That's the way it works, see? All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Got you on my mind again tonight. Seeing flashing rays of colored light.